Crunch Report. It's Emma. I know I don't look like John, but I'm sure as hell am I more charismatic. I'm better at his job. I've taken over for him while he's on vacation. Who knows if he'll ever come back. And I'm here with Michael Shore, who's one of the smartest people I've worked with and always has great analysis when it comes to politics. How you doing, Michael?
I'm great, Greg. I'm so glad you didn't open with, are you ready for some football, which I thought was the first.
Well, you know, John is so aggressively anti-sports that I wouldn't want to sully his show with my obsessive fantasy football and sports betting talk.
You would not be sullying it at all. You would be making it better. Make the damn report better again.
Exactly. Again. Make damage report better again.
Yeah. Build back better damage report.
Yeah. Repair the damage. All right.
Yeah, there you go.
So we have a big show for you guys today. Obviously, the bombshell Bob Woodward report about how Trump basically knew that coronavirus was deadly while he publicly was saying otherwise. We have a fear-mongering ad at the end of the show that Trump put out that's insanely racist towards Biden, trying to tie him to rioters and looters, and guess who they say are the rioters and looters. And also Trump's potential Supreme Court picks if he were to get another term, and if someone was to resign, they're as terrifying and dangerous as you might think. So let's get to our first story, and yeah, the story that's all over the news today. Bob Woodward of the Watergate fame, a very famous reporter, has come out with a bombshell report about what Trump knew about the coronavirus while he was downplaying it publicly. He knew that the coronavirus was, quote, deadly, and he was caught recorded saying these things. And then publicly, he was saying the opposite in order to, he says, be a strong leader, which we all know he isn't. But in the reality, it was just about downplaying the virus so that he could look better, because it's always about marketing for him, marketing himself and marketing his presidency. So here's from the Woodward report. This will be the biggest national security threat you face in your presidency, National Security Advisor Robert C. O'Brien told Trump, according to a new book by Washington Post associate editor Bob Woodward. This is going to be the roughest thing you face. So this was told to Trump. Matthew Pottinger, the deputy national security advisor, agreed. He told the president that after reaching contacts in China, it was evident that the world faced a health emergency on par with the flu pandemic of 1918, which killed an estimated 50 million people worldwide. 10 days later, Trump called Woodward and revealed that he thought the situation was far more dire than what he had been saying publicly. He said this to a reporter. You just breathe the air and that's how it's passed, Trump said in the February 7th call. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than even your strenuous flus. This is deadly stuff, the president repeated for emphasis. It's impossible to read his cadence. So this was caught on audio. Woodward, because he's a reporter and Trump decided to spill his guts to him, he recorded it, and here's what he said.
I think he's going to have it in good shape, but you know, it's a very tricky situation. It goes through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air, and that's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus.
But in March, Trump was tweeting comparing the coronavirus to the flu and saying that they were basically equivalent. He tweeted in March 9th, so last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. It averages between 27,000 and 70,000 per year. Nothing is shut down. Life and the economy go on. At this moment, there are 546 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 22 deaths. Think about that. So Trump privately was saying that it was much worse than the flu and publicly comparing it to the flu. Now, I'm reminded of the fact that the government seemed to know, and Fauci, that masks would be effective much more earlier than they told the public. And that was an effort to save masks and PPE for essential workers and people in the healthcare industry. So I don't like when the government obfuscates the truth in any regard, but this is an entirely different level. Trump knew how deadly it was and was putting out propaganda that was contrary to his own thoughts. And I just think he's not even conscious about how much he lies. It's pathological.
It's not just downplaying it either, Emma. That was March 9th, where the remarks he made where he was comparing it to the flu. And of course, we know now when he was downplaying the number of deaths. But on February 28th, 11 days before that, he was in South Carolina saying that it's a hoax. And a hoax is far different from even downplaying. It's actually denying that it even exists, that it's somehow fabricated by someone else. It also just goes to show you that most presidencies, almost all that I can think of, they either rise or fall because of something that the president has no control over, whoever that president is, whether it's 9/11, whether it's the tech boom for Bill Clinton, whether it's the Iran hostage crisis for Jimmy Carter, whether it's the jobs boom that helped to bring, that allowed Barack Obama to then come out of a recession. So I do think that what you're looking at here is something that was out of the control of the president, but you're also looking at a president who, because of what you just said, this pathological lying that's a reflexive operation for the president, because of that, it even seems worse. And that was what Bob Woodward was able to key in on. I've read, several of Bob Woodward's books, actually. Shadow is one that comes to mind. And there are parts of Bob Woodward's books where I will look and I will just shake my head because I can't believe he is going on sources for such a thing. I remember specifically there was one point where he was writing about George H.W. Bush in Shadow, which was going over, I think it was five presidencies, maybe four at the time. And he said, and George H.W. Bush looked out at the water and thought to himself, this, right? Whatever it was that he thought to himself. And I said, how do you know he thought that to himself? That the president didn't say it. He didn't interview him about that. These are the sort of suppositions that he has made in the past. Now, to quote James Comey, Lordy, there are tapes. And these tapes are damning to this president. The other part of this that I think is fascinating from an electoral standpoint is this, I think, gives Kamala Harris an opportunity in a debate against Mike Pence to ask him when he knew it. You remember, he was the one that was dealing and heading up that task force at the White House. He was the one that had the 45-day plan. Now, because we know what the president knew, when did the vice president know these things? I mean, these vice presidential debates are generally not sexy. They don't give you a lot. You don't get much from them. But in this case, you're going to take somebody, Mike Pence, who is more of a sort of mainstream conservative, very conservative Republican in that way. You're going to be able to say, look what this president said about COVID. You had to have known this, didn't you, Mr. Vice President? Be interesting to see how that comes out.
And also interesting, just the hypocrisy about being pro-life and then overseeing a pandemic and a president who downplayed it publicly and allowed people to continue carrying on with their lives, that led to hundreds of thousands of deaths potentially at the end of the year. It's probably going to be up to around 400,000 deaths by many models. So Trump actively said to Woodward, and another element and part of these recordings, that he was playing it down. He said that out loud and is now trying to cover his tracks. Here's what he said to Woodward.
Now it's turning out it's not just old people, Bob. Just today and yesterday, some startling facts came out. It's not just older.
Yeah, exactly.
Young people, to plenty of young people.
So give me a moment of talking to somebody, going through this with Fauci or somebody who kind of, it caused a pivot in your mind, because it's clear just from what's on the public record that you went through a pivot on this to, oh my God, the gravity is almost inexplicable and unexplainable.
Well, I think, Bob, really, to be honest with you.
Sure, I want you to.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
That kind of flies in the face of Trump's attempts to show that he's a truth teller. Back in 2016, they did polling on who the American public thought was more honest. And Trump blew Hillary Clinton out of the water. And in a statistic I saw a few days ago that I think is really telling and a great, great news for the Democrats in this election, Biden is perceived as way more trustworthy than Trump. And this is not going to help that polling data. It's going to hurt it significantly because I think average people will be able to see this story and go, wait, he was saying it was just going to disappear. And then behind the scenes, he was plotting about lying to the American public so that he could look better. I mean, no one buys this. I don't want to create a panic. The end result of creating a panic is, as the most of the general public knows, is all about protecting himself from political harm. And I think that comes through. I don't think he's going to be able to get away with his excuse of Bob Woodward sat on this for X amount of months so that he could sell his book. I mean, fine, that's an ancillary criticism, but I don't even think that lands at all, because when you have audio, when you have tapes, as you said, Michael, it's just irrefutable.
Yeah, and I you know, further to that notion here is that this, some of these things, now I don't believe, I don't buy that that America is dripping with undecided voters right now. So I don't think that there are too many people to sway. But I do think the people that left Trump in 2018, that left the Republicans, that they're trying to get back now in any way that they can, I think it becomes very difficult for those people to now go back. I think this is further evidence to that point. So I think the things that he had said about the military, which came to light last week, these sorts of things have some kind of enduring power, and that these will be on some voters' minds till the end. And of course, if you have the president saying that he wanted to avoid a panic, you know, sometimes panic saves lives. And in this case, panicking would save lives. If you sit in a burning theater, you are going to die in that burning theater. If you run out of that theater in a panic, you have a greater chance of surviving that. It doesn't mean walk over people. It doesn't mean anything like that. But the point we're making here, there was a pandemic in 1918, that when the country sort of came together to get around that panic, when they knew so much less about science, they were able to do that in a panicky way. This was an opportunity to just get Americans to do what we're doing now, putting on masks and staying away from each other, and doing it earlier than the president thought it was necessary. And that to me is irresponsible. You have some members of Congress on Twitter saying that it's involuntary manslaughter. I think that might be excessive, but I do think that it brings people to the mindset of thinking about it as being negligent, and this was negligent presidenting.
I think politically it goes too far, but I wouldn't say it goes too far in terms of just the facts, because we saw how Trump responded here. He really did not care how many people died. If it was all about saving face, I'm brought back to that Axios interview where he's quibbling about the statistics and the numbers and triumphant when he's looking and comparing the death rates to this other specific data point, because the only time anything resonates with him is if it's about how it appears and reflects upon him and how it makes him look to the public. And so the fact that he was talking about hiding the truth behind the scenes is just another data point that people will put in their pockets when it comes to his lack of trustworthiness. And finally, when I talk to some apolitical people, a lot of times they'll go, well, what could he have done? You know, they don't really follow the news that closely. They have no idea what's going on in other countries, how they were able to stymie the virus and return to some normalcy at a rate that seems alien to the United States. Hopefully, this story, if it gets enough coverage, can push through that fog, that malaise, that complete disconnect from how politicians and policy impacts people's lives on a daily basis. And they can see that a lot could have been done. I think that's really important. That connection needs to be made by the Biden campaign.
He's made it obvious. The president's made it obvious because we see what he didn't do, which means implicitly that something could have been done, right? And so you're 100% right. I also think what you're seeing at play here is you know, obviously we know about narcissists, and we know that the president is one, and caring about his political future is clearly much more important to him than any of the other sort of side stories here. But what you're looking at too is the chance to have saved American lives, to have been what the president, some part of the president's job profile is, which is comforter in chief. And you know, it sounds hokey, but it's also true. You go to a disaster and you hug the people who lost their home in the tornado. You hug the people who lost their family in a flood or in a fallen building. I mean, whatever you think of George Bush standing in the rubble of 9/11, talking to these people who were just shell-shocked, literally. That's what the president does. In this case, he took no empathic road, no path to making people feel better. That's also gonna hurt him, I think, in the polls. When you look at what Joe Biden, you know, whether you like Joe Biden or not, there's one thing you can't argue is that he does sort of project great empathy in times of sadness and crisis, and through experience, and I think just through how he was brought up. And I don't think you have that with Donald Trump. And he had an opportunity here, going back to the thesis that you just presented. He had an opportunity for action and he didn't take it.
You don't think Trump projects empathy, Michael?
Well, it depends on how late at night and what she looks like, I guess.
All right, well, let's move on to our next story about the terrifying prospect of Trump's Supreme Court picks.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
President Trump has floated some Supreme Court picks, potentially, if he were to be reelected or if a tragedy would happen to one of the justices. He has named 20 people, including his new bootlicking friend, Ted Cruz, and Josh Hawley. So he's trying to, I guess, appoint senators and just basically big names who are also conservative hawks, including also Tom Cotton, who's one of the scariest people in government right now. The president's running list, which he first compiled in 2016, already included more than a dozen conservative legal minds from across the country. With Wednesday's additions, he adds bulk to the number of justices he would choose from to bolster the court's conservative majority. While there's no current vacancy on the Supreme Court, it's believed the next president could appoint at least one justice. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the anchor of the court's liberal wing, is 87 and has faced recent health challenges, and Justice Stephen Breyer is 82. Justice Clarence Thomas, currently the Supreme Court's longest serving member, is 72. As of Wednesday, Trump has appointed 205 federal judges, including two Supreme Court nominees, according to a spokeswoman for the Senate Judiciary Committee. The latest iteration of Mr. Trump's list includes three sitting US senators, Tom Cotton of Arkansas, Ted Cruz of Texas, and Josh Hawley of Missouri, as well as current lawyers working in the Trump administration. Former Solicitor General Noel Francisco, who argued on behalf of the Trump administration before the Supreme Court, is also among the new contenders, as is former Solicitor General Paul Clement, who worked under President George W. Bush. The Wednesday list includes Daniel Cameron, the black conservative Kentucky attorney general, who has faced criticism over his handling of the police shooting death of Breonna Taylor, which sparked nationwide protests against police brutality. In a tweet following Trump's announcement, Hawley, one of a handful of sitting US senators and the president said he would choose from if the time came, declined the president's endorsement to the court. And he tweeted, "I appreciate the president's confidence enlisting me as a potential Supreme Court nominee. But as I told the president, Missourians elected me to fight for them in the Senate, and I have no interest in the high court. I look forward to confirming constitutional conservatives. But that means that Ted Cruz and Tom Cotton, who is really an old school hawk, they are both potentially in the running. We know that Tom Cotton is a huge advocate for wars across the globe and is basically a traditional style fascist. And Ted Cruz, despite Trump tweeting negative things about his wife and her appearance and insinuating that his father killed JFK, he's come around to kiss Trump's ring. I would say the other thing, but I don't want to get censored. And Trump is now rewarding him with this potential position. But it is very scary, because I believe if Tom Cotton or Ted Cruz or some of these other nominees were actually on the Supreme Court, they would be dogmatic in trying to overturn things like Roe v. Wade.
Well, this is a double agenda politically. I mean, just sort of getting some analysis in here. When Donald Trump, you have to look at how this is self-serving to him. And how is this self-serving? Should he lose and he wants to run again? Should he want Donald Trump Jr. to run again? These are three names that have come up, Hawley, Cotton, and Cruz, as potential candidates for the presidency next time. So there's a little field clearing that he's probably thinking about in doing this for either Mike Pence, but most likely for Donald Trump Jr., should he want to run for president in 4 years if Donald Trump Sr. loses in November. And I would say that that's the kind of thing where you kind of roll your eyes and say, oh, there's no way he does that. But this is Donald Trump. This is exactly how his mind works. So there is some field clearing here. And those are three people that could be formidable candidates as conservatives next time. Ted Cruz did come around to Donald Trump because he knew how strong the Trump brand was in Texas at a time when he was having to run for re-election. It could have been actually what put him over against Beto O'Rourke in 2018. We'll never really know exactly, but certainly adhering to Trump at that time, Trumpism in Texas among Texas Republicans was a popular brand. It still remains a popular brand. If you're going to take your boat out on a lake and watch it sink with a flag of Trump on the back, it means that there's still some appeal to Donald Trump there. The other side of this is purely political now. Donald Trump is losing support among people who identify as evangelical Christians. I still think 7 to 8 out of 10 of them will vote for Donald Trump in the fall, but Joe Biden is looked at as someone who is faithful, who uses religion as a crutch to himself emotionally, but has also been something that's been traditional in his family forever as an Irish Catholic. And many Christians believe that Donald Trump uses religion in a very transactional way, that there's absolutely no faith there. It's just something that he can use to prop himself up. And as evangelicals who have gotten there, they got Neil Gorsuch, they got Brett Kavanaugh, they got an embassy move in Jerusalem, the federal bench is now laden with conservatives. They got what they wanted by holding their nose and voting for Donald Trump. The Republicans do that much better than the Democrats. If you look at what they do in order to get their agendas through, the evangelicals in the primaries will tell you there's not a chance I'm going to vote for this monster Donald Trump. And then when it's Trump versus Clinton, and they know that there are these judgeships available, they're going to do that because it's smarter politics. Now that Trump's losing them, he has to throw some appeal to them. Hawley, Cotton, Cruz, real conservatives. Two of the three of them are very nationally recognized, one more than any of them, Ted Cruz. So it's probably good bait for evangelicals, and that's something that the president needs in a couple of months.
Don't you think, though, we could see the same dynamic where there's all of this conversation about how they couldn't be voting for Donald Trump a second time around, and then they go around and do it anyway? I mean, I have zero faith in the intellectual and moral consistency of the evangelical base in this country, to be honest with you.
You know, I think 8 out of 10 of them will vote for them. They're reliable and they're good in terms of the fact that what they do politically, look what they got. I just listed it. And I take them up against the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And I say the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party will say they're not going to vote for Joe Biden or not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and they don't. these people on the right say they're not going to vote for Donald Trump in the primaries. Then they come back and they do, and they get rewarded for it. So I do think that they're going to come out and vote. I think there may be less energy. And I think that when you, it's not just evangelical voters, religious voters of all stripes, devoutly religious voters of all stripes. I think the president will lose some of them. I don't think he's going to have the same support he did last time. I think many Catholics are going to vote for Joe Biden who didn't vote for Hillary Clinton last time. So I think it's going to be a little bit different on that score. I don't think it's going to be overwhelming, but this is an every little bit matters election because there's so few people that are undecided in this country. Anything to shift that or to protect it is smart politics.
Yeah, it is really amazing though. Just, I mean, I understand what you're saying about Biden's faith, but the difference in the reaction between Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, there's so much that has to do with the fact that the right has beat the Hillary Clinton pinata for decades and decades, and she's been the subject of a propaganda effort. I think that was severely underestimated in 2016, and that's an advantage Biden has. He hasn't been targeted in that way.
There's a built-in, and we'll take one more second on this. There's a built-in dislike that we all knew that Hillary Clinton had. It was, and we knew that it was on the Republican side. We sensed that it was on the Democratic side. The Sanders run proved that it did in 2016 exist, and a lot of those people, as we know, didn't come out and vote for Hillary Clinton. But this was built into so many voters. Joe Biden, by and large, whether you think he's fantastic or not, people like Joe Biden. He's been liked. He's been reelected seven times in Delaware. He was a popular vice president. It's part of his doing and his undoing. He's friends with people across the aisle because he wants to be friends with them, because he wants to be liked. And I think Joe Biden learned a real lesson in the primaries. It was the first time when Kamala Harris turned to him and did what she did, said what she said about busing at that Miami debate last June, in June of 2019. You listened, and we were both there, Emma. You listened and you also watched, and you watched Joe Biden. I looked at it as almost surprise on his part, saying, I can't believe somebody's being mean to me. Nobody's ever mean to Joe Biden. And I think it served him well as he's gone into the general election. I think it'll make him a better debater. I think it's made him a better candidate even this odd year. But I think what you said is absolutely true, Emma. There was a built-in dislike of Hillary Clinton that Joe Biden does not work with. And that's a huge advantage for him this time.
Definitely. A record 2.5 million acres have burned in California, and entire areas of Oregon and Washington have been burned as well. There are at least 8 deaths that are being reported, and there have been many people who have gone missing. And the Bear Fire has destroyed structures all over California. Evacuation warnings have been put in place in Pasadena. These images that have gone viral of the fires throughout California, Oregon, and Washington have just been stunning. Orange skies everywhere, ash all over people's cars. And as I mentioned earlier, at least 8 people in Oregon, California, and Washington are dead as a result of the devastating wildfires ravaging the West Coast, and the destruction and death toll are only anticipated to get worse, according to Oregon Governor Kate Brown. South of Oregon, the Golden State sky is eerily orange and red as it battles its own destructive wildfires. There are more than 24 active fires in California. And California Governor Gavin Newsom said the viral images of an orange sky in San Francisco and other parts of the state are a cry out for change. He said to help prevent future wildfires, all levels of government must step up to fight climate change. So these are some of the images that Gavin Newsom shared. You guys can see how just bleak that is. I mean, it looks like we're the Dune trailer or another Denis Villeneuve movie. But this is reality under the constant threat of climate change. And Sunrise LA did tweet out a response to Gavin Newsom. He said, yeah, vote you out of office because we're S blank out of luck with you in office. We need a GND, Green New Deal champion, not you. So strong words for Gavin Newsom. We also saw President Obama tweeted about the threat of climate change, and a lot of lefties responded, well, you could have done more when you were president, as opposed to just kind of these tweaks around the edges, entering into the Paris Accord. Obviously, what I'm encouraged by is that Joe Biden did put Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashini Prakash, and other Sunrise Movement activists on his climate change panel. And his proposal is not bad. It doesn't ban fracking. He's emphatic about that. But there are good elements there. And the contrast between him and Donald Trump specifically on this issue is quite stark.
Yeah, and I think when you look at Joe Biden is ahead of the game on this. He did listen to people. He has Jay Inslee's endorsement. So in sort of in Democratic elected officialdom, I think Jay Inslee is one of the models right now. Ocasio-Cortez as a congresswoman doesn't have as much say. Of course, her voice goes farther than most people in America. But when Jay Inslee endorses what you're doing on climate from a presidential campaign standpoint, I think it's great. It's not about necessarily for me looking back and saying what Obama didn't do. He certainly didn't pull us out of an accord. He kept us in and brought us into a conversation globally about climate, acknowledged its presence. And this is something that is as an issue, Al Gore was the first to talk about it. He talked about the environment loudly from that podium. He talked about it as a candidate. He sort of gave his life to it. But even he said that it wasn't an issue until that climate was not an issue until it is an issue, until you can feel it. So as we feel it from Katrina forward to these fires, to other floods and fires that we've experienced over the years, now we're almost numb to it with the hurricanes starting in July in devastating ways, tropical storms being formed, cyclones in Asia and the Southern Hemisphere, tropical storms here in our hemisphere. These sorts of things are starting to make people feel it on a daily basis in their backyard. That's important for any issue. Gore knew it then. He said it's going to start happening. We're ahead of the game now, and we just have to keep up with the game. It seems like Joe Biden's doing as much as he can as a candidate to keep up with the game. You're not going to get perfection. You're not going to, hear somebody campaign for a ban on fracking and win the presidency in Pennsylvania when fracking is now creating so many jobs in Pennsylvania. It's just not sound politics, but you can meet it. It's not sound politics yet, and for this election, for this candidate, but you certainly can meet it in less of a way than Biden did. And he went even further than many people thought he was going to go, not just with people, but with policy. I think that's pretty encouraging.
I mean, I think I would disagree just in terms of I think you can provide an alternative vision via Green New Deal for job creation that is going to be more long lasting. I hear what you're saying, but the thing about it.
No, Emma, I'm not arguing. This is more about job elimination, though. And there you can't. I agree with you.
Or
I
job
agree
transitioning, that there are other, though.
What's that? But what I'm saying is that the fracking, a ban on fracking, would eliminate so many people in the Mahoning Valley of Ohio and in Western Pennsylvania. It would eliminate jobs. It's a hard sell to make. Job creation through a Green New Deal, I totally agree with you. And that's a sound and impressive way to get rid of fracking and then use the Green New Deal to create jobs. But you have to make it so it's not just a net loss at the beginning. And when you're running for president in a finite period of time and you have people whose votes you need in a state that the Democrats lost last time, there's certain things that you can mess with and certain things not to. It doesn't mean he's going to be right. He may not win Pennsylvania. He may have been wrong in not being a good leader about it. But in terms of the politics, I see why his campaign decided that.
No, certainly. And also, I don't necessarily believe Biden strongly feels that fracking should be banned. So what I do appreciate about Biden in contrast to Hillary Clinton is that even though he might be further right than her politically in some areas of her career, although she became more entrenched in the center left later in her life, I do appreciate about Biden that he's more upfront than she ever was. And I think that goes to his honesty quotient. I tried to combine quadrant and quota.
His HQ, his HQ, his honesty quotient.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, but I just, we're taking a climate change story and bringing it back to Biden. But I do think it's key that he did release that plan. I hope he emphasizes it more. But again, any messaging that comes out right now, it's just being drowned out by coronavirus, by Black Lives Matter. And Trump, he has no shame in lying about specific issues like the fact that he's saying that Biden is in favor of rioting and looting, that a lot of these plans that Biden has put out there, they're not getting any traction because we're so mucked. We're so in the muck and it's being drowned out by these obfuscations.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that when you, you know, look, it's hard not to bring it back to the election because it's what we're living with 54 days beforehand and how we analyze it. But you're right. I mean, there is an honesty. And there's also one thing that's good for progressives with Joe Biden is that Joe Biden, as we said earlier, I said, and I suspect you agreed with to a degree, is he likes to be liked. Right. And so that carries a lot of weight for him. So he wants everybody to like him, which means he wants progressives to like them. He wants to give something to them to get their support and their affection. And that's a good thing to have in a president if you are trying to win him over on an issue. I don't know. I tend to agree with you. I don't know where he stands on fracking. I think he's probably not opposed to fracking, but I think he's not opposed to fracking because he's been a politician for most of his life. And he understands that in this particular election where he has to be opposed to fracking, or he feels like he has to be in favor of fracking, it's not as easy to be as opposed to fracking. But I think if it were different, he might just say, yeah, fracking's ridiculous. He's been ahead on some issues over time, and maybe this is the environment is one. And now that you see the world and California and Oregon and so many places as a tinderbox, I think that it's really it's important to realize that the next president's going to have to embrace it certainly far more than this one has and the previous one has.
Yeah, tinderbox is an unfortunately apt description for what's happening. I hope you guys in California are staying safe out there.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to our next story about a whistleblower and Russia, 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 Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. So, the Department of Homeland Security has a whistleblower who made an official complaint that the head of the DHS, Chad Wolf, basically told him to stop doing reporting and research on a Russian national security threat because it, quote, made President Trump look bad. Here are some of the details. The DHS official Brian Murphy made the accusation in a formal whistleblower complaint filed Tuesday with the department's inspector general. Murphy ran the Office of Intelligence and Analysis at DHS until the end of July when he was demoted to a lesser management job. Murphy says the acting secretary of DHS, Chad Wolf, told him twice, once in May and again in July, to withhold reporting on potential Russian threats to the election because it cast the president in a bad light. Murphy says he was also told to emphasize potential threats from China and Iran because that fits Trump's agenda. Murphy says Wolf told him these instructions came from the White House National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien. On July 8th, Murphy said in the complaint, acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf told him that an intelligence notification regarding Russian disinformation efforts should be held because it was unflattering to Trump, who has long derided the Kremlin's interference as a hoax that was concocted by his opponents to delegitimize his victory in 2016. Murphy objected to Wolf's instruction, stating that it was improper to hold a vetted intelligence product for reasons of political embarrassment, according to a copy of his whistleblower complaint that was obtained by the Washington Post. In the 22-page complaint, Murphy says there were multiple meetings this summer about downplaying the domestic threat posed by white supremacists and focusing more on militant leftist movements like Antifa. According to the document, Wolf and his deputy, Ken Cusolini, told Murphy to modify intelligence assessments to ensure they matched up with public comments by President Trump. Murphy says he declined to do so. In a statement, Murphy's lawyer, Mark Zaid, said his client followed proper lawful whistleblower rules in reporting serious allegations of misconduct against DHS leadership. We flatly deny that there is any truth to the merits of Mr. Murphy's claim, said DHS spokesperson Alexei Wolternist. The Homeland Security chief is focused on thwarting election interference from any foreign powers and attacks from any extremist group. That is patently false. There have been multiple reports about the Department of Homeland Security completely ignoring the large threat of white supremacist violence, which is Antifa is not even an organization. It's not even an organization. And there hasn't been a death or a terrorist attack caused by Antifa in 25 years of recording this. It's been long documented. But when it comes back to Chad Wolf and the Department of Homeland Security here, this seems like a coordinated effort because when you look at the Republicans' new bill that was proposed by Mitch McConnell, the skinny bill that everyone's talking about, the coronavirus relief package, it doesn't have any money for election integrity either. So they basically want to muddy the waters so much that Trump can claim victory even under dubious circumstances. And just to point out Chad Wolf's specific hypocrisy, he was talking about Kamala Harris and what she would be as vice president and why he fears that she would not be good because she would selectively enforce certain laws, which is exactly what it seems like Chad Wolf is doing.
You're saying that Senator Harris as vice president would be a security risk.
I did not say that. What I did say is I would be concerned about their priorities. I'd be concerned about their selective enforcement of certain laws and requirements that DHS has to administer on a daily basis.
Seems like conservative projection, which is a familiar phenomenon often exhibited by Trump himself. What do you think, Michael?
I mean, what you fill the offices with your acolytes, and nobody does it better than Donald Trump, from his family members to people that just march in lockstep with him. I think what you have with Chad Wolf, and most especially with Ken Cuccinelli, who as the former attorney general in Virginia, was somebody who really tried to crack down on voting rights in that state. And so you are trying to keep the voices of dissent away, whether at the ballot box or within the organization. My macro prediction about this is that the Department of Homeland Security, should the Democrats win the Senate, the House, and the White House, I think there's going to be a serious conversation about disbanding that department, because I think that as time has gone on, it was created in the wake of 9/11. As time has gone on, it has had too much politics in it to hold its name up of Homeland Security. It's not about politics with Homeland Security. It's about protecting the country. And these guys on this mission are protecting the president. They're not protecting the country. I think a lot of smart people are starting to see this on both sides, because a lot of Republicans think it's government waste in the first place. But now a lot of Democrats are seeing to see what a political tool it is for the president. But, you know, when they get power, maybe they'll want to use it again as well.
Well, I mean, I think it's a part of trying to dismantle some of these institutions that have gotten entirely out of hand after 9/11, after the Patriot Act. DHS is enormously corrupt and authoritarian. We saw that Trump deployed unmarked DHS troops to basically quell the protests, but really just instigate it further in the wake of the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent protests. But also, I think the broader conversation is about ICE as well, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Both are policey, and they have way too much leeway and power and not very much oversight, which is terrifying. And I think that the Democrats could focus their efforts a little bit more on getting rid of those institutions. I believe in abolishing ICE, although I know Biden is out for the run on that. And at least, at the very least, scaling some of these things back and reallocating resources to other things like education and healthcare, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get the abolition of ICE.
I can dream, Michael. I can dream.
You can dream. But I do think you get the abolition of the Department of Homeland Security. And I don't think that's as much of a pipe dream, because I think that splitting it up and taking some of those operations and putting them back in the Defense Department, the Treasury Department, I think is something that people would look at as being sound policy, and would also get the behemoth of government out of so many of these things that affect so many people directly. But we're getting away, or I took us away from this whole whistleblower idea. And the fact that a whistleblower within DHS is not being heard, because acting secretary, this is not the Secretary of Homeland Security. So we always have to put the acting in front of Chad Wolf, because he has not had the same approval process that other secretaries and cabinet level positions have had, that he is overlooking and putting his political imprint on something. And now that it's come to light, I think that there will be conversations about this in the downfall of DHS, but also in the way that the next administration will look at whistleblowers and maybe embrace what it is that they're trying to get done.
Certainly. I mean, well, I would argue that the Obama administration didn't treat whistleblowers particularly well. Sorry.
No. I'm saying they absolutely didn't. I would say that they didn't do that. But I think these lessons of what whistleblowers are doing now, and in a department that is coming under fire, I would say the Obama administration was terrible. Look, I don't think anyone's ever been good to whistleblowers. It's a thankless job being a whistleblower. You're a hero for doing it, but it very, very rarely works, and it's never embraced by power, because it usually is something that is trying to cripple power in some way, and it's a shame, but there have to be protections that are used and used positively. But because there was so much whistleblowing from this administration, from people in the administration to underlings in this administration, I think that maybe people are going to take another look at it. It's certainly going to be more positive under a Biden-Harris administration, I would think, than it is under a Trump-Pence administration, where there are these elements of sort of authoritarianism which are built into the way they govern.
Yeah, I would agree. Just in terms of the proportional, it's going to be like night and day, I would say, in terms of many aspects. Donald Trump released a horrific new ad last night that really drums up fear-mongering, includes Ilhan Omar, Kamala Harris, and very obvious racist dog whistles. So with that said, just let's take a look.
This is a movement, I'm telling you. They're not gonna stop, and they should not.
These people are tearing up our last people.
A third straight night, Portland police declared a riot.
The vast majority of the protests have been peaceful.
Over the weekend, 59 officers injured and 47 people arrested.
New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announcing a proposal to cut $1 billion from the New York City Police Department.
We need to completely dismantle the Minneapolis Police Department.
Won't be safe in Joe Biden's America.
That's an ugly ad. If you notice at the end, it shows Joe Biden kneeling with some Black Americans, and then immediately after it says "Stop the rioters." Who do you think they're talking about?
No, of course you. But until it's what's interesting for me in that ad, until you hear the voice saying, you know, talking about how dangerous Joe Biden was, that could have been an ad for why you need to elect Joe Biden, to me. I mean, and why you need to elect Democrats. You see Nancy Pelosi taking a knee with members of Congress. You see Joe Biden taking a knee with people protesting. You see all the chaos here that's been sown under Donald Trump. And then you find out that it's in fact a really racist ad being run by Donald Trump in a tradition of racist ads dating back to at least Willie Horton, but probably a little bit further back into the civil rights movement era in 64, Johnson Goldwater. But here you're seeing this stuff with the Willie Horton ad. He was when Mike Dukakis was running in 1980, he was a furloughed prisoner when Dukakis was governor of Massachusetts, came out and killed somebody or raped somebody. And that was used against Mike Dukakis. And you saw these Black men going through a turnstile at a prison. And that was about as racist an ad as I've ever seen. And this one, when you hear it's an ad for Donald Trump, turns into an outrageously racist ad.
And to me, I get so disgusted by the gratuitous showing of Representative Ilhan Omar repeatedly, over and over again. Not faced enough death threats, enough anger, enough vitriol, enough racism, enough xenophobia for a lifetime. I mean, that's one of the grossest things I've seen recently on the right, is their willingness to just go after her and make her this boogeyman or boogeywoman specifically. And it has to do with the fact that she's from a different country, that she's Muslim, that she's a woman, and that she's Black. And it's this trifecta that just triggers the right. There's no real connection between Ilhan Omar and Joe Biden, but they make that connection in that ad specifically to drum up fears and racist attitudes. And this is what they're running on. I mean, what Michael said is true. This is a standard playbook by Republicans going back decades, where they talk about law and order and they talk about lawlessness, and Democrats are going to create lawlessness and we're going to be tough on crime and the streets are going to be clean. I don't think it plays that well. One, because at the same time, they're trying to talk about how Joe Biden wrote the crime bill. Okay, then what is it? Was Biden too tough on crime when he wrote the crime bill, which is the reality? Or is he in bed with Antifa and rioters and looters, and Biden is coming out and doing ads himself, having to respond to this slander and saying, I do not believe rioting and looting should be happening. I believe it's illegal, it's bad behavior, it's not protesting, whatever. But this is what we're having a conversation about now, and I don't think that's what's on people's minds. When everyone is waking up in quarantine, when there's over 190,000 Americans who have died of COVID-19, when the economy is in the depression, when there's mass unemployment, tens of millions of Americans unemployed, it's really difficult to change the conversation to rioting and looting. And especially when you don't have a coherent message, and Biden's lawlessness and that vision of him is already shaky. I just don't know how you can effectively make that case.
No, and they're not effectively making it. If you look at the polling in Wisconsin since Kenosha, when the Republicans and Bill Stepien, who runs the president's campaign, started making Kenosha, making this about law and order, making this about the differences between the chaos that Joe Biden is endorsing and what Donald Trump is saying, even though somehow it's happening while he's president, somehow he's not responsible for it, but the guy who was vice president 4 years ago is. I think when you see that it's not working and you see polling in Wisconsin not moving at all since Kenosha, I think they're going to have to look at this and say, you know, maybe this isn't working. Maybe this isn't the road down which to go. And for a lot of Republicans, it's Ilhan Omar. For many Republicans, though, it's a Muslim woman, because they don't know who Ilhan Omar is. It's the other. And it's been the other for Republicans for a very long time in America, going back to Eleanor Roosevelt, who was this woman who was powerful within her husband's home, which they hadn't seen before. So they made it about Eleanor Roosevelt, moving into other times when you'd have black, you had Jesse Jackson in 1984, using him as a candidate, showing that the Democrats are embracing Jesse Jackson's radical agenda. And then, of course, as we know, going into 88 with Willie Horton, and the other that you had with Hillary Clinton for a long time. Now you have Omar, now you have Ocasio-Cortez. They use it well generally. I don't think they're using it well here.
Yeah, when material conditions for people on the ground are this bad, I just find the efforts to lean into culture wars so silly. But I've had really depressing conversations with smart people about how perhaps politics have become so disconnected from material conditions that this might work. I don't think it does, but yeah. I can't.
I don't think it does now. I think you're right. I think you're right. I don't think it does. And I think just one more thing, like this isn't new. And when I say they've used it well and they've done well with it, they've won because of it, right? These ads have resonated. I still think they were ugly before I was born with Eleanor Roosevelt. They were ugly with Hillary Clinton, they're ugly with Nancy Pelosi, and they're uglier now with Ilhan Omar. But they have worked. This time I don't think they're gonna work, because I don't think that people are tuned into this right now. And when they don't have a job and their economies are shut down, just not gonna happen.
I think you're right. So that ends our stories for today. And I wanted to completely, basically metaphorically spit in John's face and talk about sports a little bit with Michael, since the NFL season kicks off tonight. Cool. So I'm just going a little off book here. We're in the same fantasy football league. You are a San Francisco 49ers fan. Your son is an incredibly smart football fan. We actually watched the Super Bowl together in Iowa. That was really fun, Michael. Who are your Super Bowl picks for this year?
It was 73 years ago that we did that.
I know. Isn't that amazing that was this year, 2020?
It seems, honestly, I mean, that was the Iowa caucuses. It seems so long ago. It's interesting. I think that the Houston Texans are going to be really good this year. I don't love the Houston Texans. I don't think they're well coached, but I think they're going to be really good. And I think they're a team to watch. I don't think the Niners are going to be the team that prevails out of the West and out of the NFC. I don't think they have enough. And I think they got, I wouldn't say lucky last year, but they did better than they probably should have. I'm not a big seller, a big buyer on the Philadelphia Eagles, but if they can put something together, if we get the Carson Wentz of a couple of years ago, and I know you hate to hear this as a Giants fan, but I do think that they are a good football team, a much more sound football team now, and they have a running game that's sort of got two heads on it, and I think that's important.
Yeah, they're just always struck with injuries, though. You've got to question what they're doing there in terms of practicing and conditioning. I, by the way, placed a few months ago some bets on the Houston Texans winning the division because they were third in terms of odds, and it was like plus 300 because it was right after they lost DeAndre Hopkins. And if there was a weakness to Deshaun Watson's game, it was that he literally only threw to DeAndre Hopkins and he would stare him down, and it kind of limited them because their offense isn't creative. Talk about the Niners, they have a creative offense. Talk about the Chiefs, they have a creative offense. So hopefully I think Deshaun Watson's going to have a great year. I just don't think that defense is very good, but I know you drafted Deshaun Watson as your quarterback. So yeah, he's going to have a great statistical year.
I think they have a running game, which they never had. So, I mean, they've always suffered in running, and they could have a really good running game this year, which I think would go a long way to seeing their success there. I like your bet.
Yeah, and I will say, so just to button this up, I know people are dying here. I agree with you on the Niners. I don't think they have the physically gifted quarterback to take them over the edge. I mean, they outplayed the Chiefs in that Super Bowl, but it doesn't matter when Mahomes just puts the team on his back. So I think that what's going to be really interesting about this year is I think continuity is going to win out. Teams that had success last year and have stable coaches and coaching systems, they will be successful, with maybe the exception of the Cowboys, who I think maybe they'll bounce back. They seem to have a bad year and then have a good year the next year. Yeah. So I think the Cowboys will bounce back. But I think teams that had coaching changes are going to be at a massive disadvantage because of COVID-19, no preseason, no live reps. But yeah, so I'm high on the Texans, and I think those odds for them not winning, they count them out every year. And then you have one of the three most talented quarterbacks in the league. Four are fine. It's definitely Mahomes, it's Lamar Jackson, it's Russell Wilson, and it's Deshaun Watson. So and Aaron Rodgers, but he's declining a bit. So yeah.
Yeah. And never forget the Saints. They somehow sneak up on you.
I know, but when it's December and January, I don't think Breeze can throw anymore. His arm gets so weak towards the end of the year.
Yeah, maybe they'll run more than they have, and because they're playing different kinds of defenses now. Tampa and against Tampa, certainly, and Carolina, that's a different type of defense with Ron Rivera gone, I'm guessing. So
Latavius Murray, good depth piece on your fantasy team. All right.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.